I preached at 5 in the small house they have just built, and the hearers were remarkably serious. I gave notice of preaching at 5 in the morning, but at half hour after 4, one brought us word that the wind was come fair, and Captain Jordan would sail in less than an hour. We were soon in the ship, wherein we found about 80 passengers. The sun shone brightly, the wind was moderate, the sea smooth, and we wanted nothing but room to stir ourselves, the cabin being filled with hops, so that we could not get into it but by climbing over them on our hands and knees. In the afternoon we were abreast of Holyhead, but the scene was quickly changed. The wind rose higher and higher, and by 7 o'clock blew a storm. The sea broke over us continually and sometimes covered the ship, which both pitched and rolled in an uncommon manner. So I was informed, for being a little sick, I lay down at 6 and slept with little intermission till nearly 6 in the morning. We were then near Dublin Bay, where we went into a boat which carried us to Dunleary. There we met with a chaise just ready, in which we went to Dublin. Remarkable speaking statue. Monday, April 26. In the evening I preached to a large congregation in the market house at Lurgan. I now embraced the opportunity which I had long desired of talking with Mr. Miller, the contriver of that statue which was in Lurgan when I was there before. It was the figure of an old man standing in a case with a curtain drawn before him, over against a clock which stood on the other side of the room. Every time the clock struck, he opened the door with one hand, drew back the curtain with the other, turned his head as if looking round on the company, and then said in a clear, loud, articulate voice, "Past 1, 2, 3, and so on. But so many came to see this, the like of which all allowed was not to be seen in Europe, that Mr. Miller was in danger of being ruined, not having time to attend his own business. So as none offered to purchase it or reward him for his pains, he took the whole machine in pieces, nor has he any thought of ever making anything of the kind again. Wednesday the 28th. In the morning I rode to Monaghan. The commotions in Munster having now alarmed all Ireland. We had hardly alighted when some wise persons informed the provost there were 3 strange sort of men come to the King's Arms. So the provost with his officers came without delay to secure the north from so imminent a danger. I had just come out when I was required to return into the house. The provost asked me many questions, and perhaps the affair might have turned serious had I not had 2 letters with me, which I had lately received, one from the Bishop of Londonderry, the other from the Earl of Moira. Upon reading these, he excused himself for the trouble he had given and wished me a good journey. Between 6 and 7, I preached at Coot Hill, and in the morning rode on to Enniskillen. After riding round and round, we came in the evening to a lone house called Carrick Abeg. It lay in the midst of horrid mountains and had no very promising appearance. However, it afforded corn for our horses and potatoes for us. So we made a hearty supper, called in as many as pleased of the family to prayers, and though we had no fastening either for our doors or our windows, slept in peace. Wesley and the Oatmeal Sellers. Monday, May 3rd, Sligo. In the evening, a company of players began acting in the upper part of the market house, just as we began singing in the lower. The case of these is remarkable. The Presbyterians for a long time had their public worship here, but when the strollers came to town, they were turned out and from that time had no public worship at all. On Tuesday evening, the lower part too was occupied by buyers and sellers of oatmeal. But as soon as I began, the people quitted their sacks and listened to business of greater importance. Sunday the 16th. I had observed to the society last week that I had not seen one congregation over in Ireland behave so ill as at church as that at Elphlone, laughing and staring about during the whole service. I had added, "This is your fault, for if you had attended the church as you ought to have done, your presence and example would not have failed to influence the whole congregation." And so it appeared. I saw not one today, either laughing, talking, or staring about, but a remarkable seriousness was spread from the one end of the church to the other. The Irish White Boys. Monday the 24th. I went with two friends to see one of the greatest natural wonders in Ireland, Mount Eagle, vulgarly called Crow Patrick. The foot of it is 14 miles from Castlebar. There we left our horses and procured a guide. It was just 12 when we alighted. The sun was burning hot, and we had not a breath of wind. Part of the ascent was a good deal steeper than an ordinary pair of stairs. About 2, we gained the top, which is an oval grassy plain about 150 yards in length and 70 or 80 in breadth. The upper part of the mountain much resembles the peak of Tenerife. I think it cannot rise much less than a mile perpendicular from the plain below. There is an immense prospect on one side toward the sea and on the other over the land. But as most of it is waste and uncultivated, the prospect is not very pleasing. Monday, June 14, I rode to Cork. Here I procured an exact account of the late commotions. About the beginning of December last, a few men met by night near Ninog in the county of Limerick and threw down the fences of some commons, which had been lately enclosed. Near the same time, the others met in the county of Tipperary, of Waterford, and of Cork. As no one offered to suppress or hinder them, they increased in number continually and called themselves White Boys, wearing white cockades and white linen frocks. In February, there were 5 or 6 parties of them, 200 or 300 men in each, who moved up and down, chiefly in the night, but for what end did not appear. Only they leveled a few fences, dug up some grounds, and hamstrung some cattle, perhaps 50 or 60 in all. One body of them came into Clohean of about 500 foot and 200 horse. They moved as exactly as regular troops and appeared to be thoroughly disciplined. They now sent letters to several gentlemen threatening to pull down their houses. They compelled everyone they met to take an oath to be true to Queen Zide, whatever that meant, and the White Boys not to reveal their secrets and to join them when called upon. It was supposed that 8,000 or 10,000 were now actually risen, many of them well armed, and that a far greater number were ready to rise whenever they should be called upon. Those who refused to swear, they threatened to bury alive. 2 or 3 they did bury up to the neck and left them. These would quickly have perished had they not been found in time by some traveling by. At length, toward Easter, a body of troops, chiefly light horse, was sent against them. Many were apprehended and committed to jail. The rest of them disappeared. This is the plain, naked fact which has been so variously represented. Whitewashing Kilkenny Marble. Saturday, July 10. We rode to Kilkenny, one of the pleasantest and the most ancient cities in the kingdom, and not inferior to any at all in wickedness or in hatred to this way. I was therefore glad of a permission to preach in the town hall, where a small serious company attended the evening, Sunday 11. I went to the cathedral, one of the best built which I have seen in Ireland. The pillars are all of black marble, but the late bishop ordered them to be whitewashed. Indeed, marble is so plentiful near this town that the very streets are paved with it. Monday the 12th. I went to Dunmore Cave, 3 or 4 miles from Kilkenny. It is fully as remarkable as Pool's Hole or any other in the peak. The opening is round, parallel to the horizon, and 70 or 80 yards across. In the midst of this, there is a kind of arch, 20 or 30 feet high. By this, you enter into the first cave, which is nearly round and 40 or 50 feet in diameter. It is encompassed with sparse stones, just like those on the sides of Pool's Hole. On one side of the cave is a narrow passage, which goes under the rock 200 or 300 yards. On the other, a hollow which no one has ever been able to find an end of. I suppose this hole, too, as well as many others, was formed by the waters of the deluge retreating into the great abyss with which probably it communicates. Monday the 26th. In some respects, the work of God in Dublin was more remarkable than even that in London. One, it is far greater in proportion to the time and to the number of people. That society had above 720 members, this not a fifth part of the number. 6 months after the flame broke out there, we had about 30 witnesses of the great salvation. In Dublin, there were about 40 in less than 4 months. Two, the work was more pure. In all this time, while they were mildly and tenderly treated, there were none of them headstrong or inadvisable, none that were wiser than their teachers, none who dreamed of being immortal or infallible or incapable of temptation. In short, no whimsical or enthusiastic persons. All were calm and sober-minded. Wesley in Cornwall. Friday, August 27th. I set out for the West, and having preached at Shepton and Middlesey in the way, came on Saturday to Exeter. When I began the service there, the congregation beside ourselves were two women and one man. Before I had done, the room was about half full. This comes of omitting field preaching. Sunday the 29th. I preached at 8 on Southern A Green to an extremely quiet congregation. At the cathedral, we had a useful sermon, and the whole service was performed with great seriousness and decency. Such an organ I never saw or heard before, so large, beautiful, and so finely toned, and the music of Glory Be to God in the Highest, I think, exceeded the Messiah itself. I was well pleased to partake of the Lord's Supper with my old opponent, Bishop Lavington. Oh, may we sit down together in the kingdom of our Father. At 5, I went to Southern A Green again and found a multitude of people, but a lewd, profane, drunken vagabond had so stirred up many of the baser sort that there was much noise, hurry, and confusion. While I was preaching, several things were thrown and much pains taken to overturn the table. And after I concluded, many endeavored to throw me down, but I walked through the midst and left them. Saturday, September 4th. After preaching in Crampound, I rode on to Truro. I almost expected there would be some disturbance, as it was market day, and I stood in the street at a small distance from the market. But all was quiet. Indeed, both persecution and popular tumult seemed to be forgotten in Cornwall. Sunday the 5th. As I was enforcing in the same place those solemn words, God forbid that I should glory save in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, Galatians 6:14. A poor man began to make some tumult, but many cried out, "Constables, take him away." They did so, and the hurry was over. At 1, I preached in the main street at Redruth, where rich and poor were equally attentive. The wind was so high at 5 that I could not stand in the usual place at Gwynedd, but at a small distance was a hollow capable of containing many thousand people. I stood on one side of this amphitheater toward the top, with the people beneath and on all sides, and enlarged on those words in the Gospel for the day, Luke 10:23-24. Blessed are the eyes which see the things that ye see, and which hear the things that ye hear. Wednesday the 15th. The more I converse with the believers in Cornwall, the more I am convinced that they have sustained great loss for want of hearing the doctrine of Christian perfection clearly and strongly enforced. I see that wherever this is not done, the believers grow dead and cold. Nor can this be prevented but by keeping up in them an hourly expectation of being perfected in love. I say an hourly expectation, for to expect it at death or sometime hence is much the same as not expecting it at all. That detestable practice of cheating the king, smuggling, is no more found in our societies. And since that accursed thing has been put away, the work of God has everywhere increased. Monday, October 25th. I preached at 1 in the shell of the new house at Shepton Mallet. In digging the foundation, they found a quarry of stone which was more than sufficient for the house. Thursday, the 28th. One who had adorned the gospel in life and in death, having desired that I should preach her funeral sermon, I went with a few friends to the house and sang before the body to the room. I did this the rather to show my approbation of that solemn custom and to encourage others to follow it. As we walked, our company swiftly increased, so that we had a very numerous congregation at the room. And who can tell but some of these may bless God from it to all eternity. Wesley's Day of Pentecost. Many years ago, my brother frequently said, "Your day of Pentecost is not fully come, but I doubt not it will. And you will then hear of persons sanctified as frequently as you do now of persons justified." Any unprejudiced reader may observe that it was now fully come. And accordingly, we did hear of persons sanctified in London and most other parts of England, and in Dublin and many other parts of Ireland, as frequently as of persons justified, although instances of the latter were far more frequent than they had been for 20 years before. That many of these did not retain the gift of God is no proof that it was not given them. That many do retain it to this day is matter of praise and thanksgiving. And many of them are gone to Him whom they loved, praising Him with their latest breath, just in the spirit of Anne Steed, the first witness in Bristol of the great salvation, who, being worn out with sickness and racking pain, after she had commended to God all that were round her, lifted up her eyes, cried aloud, "Glory, hallelujah," and died. Chapter 13. Wesley in Scotland again. Methodist wealth. No law for Methodists. Exhausting days. Whitfield. Wesley in Aberdeen again. 1763, Monday, May 16. Setting out a month later than usual, I judged it needful to make the more haste, so I took post chaises and by that means easily reached Newcastle on Wednesday the 18th. Thence I went on at leisure and came to Edinburgh on Saturday the 21st. The next day I had the satisfaction of spending a little time with Mr. Whitfield. Humanly speaking, he is worn out, but we have to do with him who hath all power in heaven and earth. Monday the 23rd, I rode to Forfar, and on Tuesday the 24th rode on to Aberdeen. Wednesday the 25th, I inquired into the state of things here. Surely never was there a more open door. The four ministers of Aberdeen, the minister of the adjoining town, and the three ministers of Old Aberdeen, hitherto seem to have no dislike, but rather to wish us good luck in the name of the Lord. Most of the townspeople as yet seem to wish us well, so that there is no open opposition of any kind. Oh, what spirit ought a preacher to be of that he may be able to bear all this sunshine? About noon I went to Gordon's Hospital, built near the town for poor children. It is an exceedingly handsome building, and, what is not common, kept exceedingly clean. The gardens are pleasant, well laid out in an extremely good order, but the old bachelor who founded it has expressly provided that no woman should ever be there. At 7, the evening being fair and mild, I preached to a multitude of people in the college close on "Stand in the ways and see and ask for the old paths," Jeremiah 6:16. But the next evening, the weather being raw and cold, I preached in the college hall. What an amazing willingness to hear runs through this whole kingdom. There want only a few zealous, active laborers who desire nothing but God, and they might soon carry the gospel through all this country, even as high as the Orkneys. Plain dealing in Scotland. Friday the 27th. I set out for Edinburgh again. About one I preached at Brecon. All were deeply attentive. Perhaps a few may not be forgetful hearers. Afterward we rode on to Boughteek Castle, 2 or 3 miles below Dundee. We were in hopes of passing the river here,